Governor Prasan, former governors and deputy governors, senior officials of the Thai government, Mr. Ambassador, other distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to be here today. And thank you so much for the invitation to come back to Bangkok. Monday of this week marked the 70th anniversary of the commencement of operations of the Bank of Thailand on 10 December of 1942. Conceived under wartime occupation, the bank has grown to be a key institution in Thailand. And as I say, it's a pleasure to be here to mark the anniversary, and I thank you, Governor, and your colleagues for the invitation. The Reserve Bank of Australia has long enjoyed a strong relationship with the Bank of Thailand. In 1997, the RBA was amongst those central banks to extend a bilateral currency swap to the Bank of Thailand shortly after the crisis broke. That was, in fact, the first part of Australian assistance to regional partners who were under pressure in the Asian crisis. That support later extended to Indonesia and Korea, and in fact Australia and Japan were the only countries to extend bilateral support to all three of those countries. It was a predecessor of mine, Bernie Fraser, who made the suggestion 17 years ago that cooperation in the Asian region might be improved by the establishment of a dedicated institution for central banks along the lines of the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, the so-called Asian BIS. Well, such a body has not come to pass, or at least not yet, but it is fair to say I think that that suggestion and others like it helped to spur the BIS in Basel to reach out to Asia much more strongly than it had up to that point. The central banks in the region, through the auspices of the Executives Meeting of East Asia and Pacific Central Banks, or EMEAP, probably not the most attractive acronym, but EMEAP has improved its coordination and cooperation considerably over the 17 years since Governor Fraser made that suggestion. Thanks to long-term efforts at building relationships and the vision of key governors and deputy governors, among them important people from the Bank of Thailand, EMEAP has grown into a mature forum for sharing information, and it continues to develop its capabilities at developing common positions on global issues and in its efforts to promote crisis readiness. But as the central banks have grown closer and as we become more effective in cooperating, the challenges we face have only increased. So today what I want to do is to speak about three of them. There are more than three challenges, to be sure, but I'll talk only about three. The first of those is the framework for monetary policy and the need to allow that to better take account of financial stability. The second challenge is the more prominent role that central banks' own balance sheets are playing in financial arrangements in the various countries. Happily, in our two countries, we don't have bloated balance sheets, but in the major countries, that's quite a big issue. And then thirdly, I want to talk about make some observations about international spillovers. In doing all of that, I'm of course not seeking to deliver any particular message about the near-term course of monetary policy, either in Thailand or in Australia. So to challenges in the monetary policy arena. It's more than two decades now since inflation targeting was pioneered in Canada and New Zealand. The United Kingdom was an enthusiastic early adopter of inflation targeting, and my own country adopted it from 1993. The move to inflation targeting was driven by a mixture of principle and pragmatism. The principle behind it was the recognition that monetary policy ultimately is about the value of money, that is, it's about price stability. And the pragmatism arose because previous approaches designed to achieve that price stability things like monetary targeting or exchange rate targeting or just unconstrained discretion had proven at best ineffective and at worst destabilising for some of the countries concerned. Hence, many of the early adopters, and we would put ourselves in Australia in this position, shared a desire to strengthen the credibility of their policy frameworks. As the initial adopters of inflation targeting came to have a certain degree of success, other countries were attracted to adopt the framework. According to the IMF, more than 30 countries now profess to be inflation targeters. That number does not include the euro area, but I think you could really count the euro area as among that group. They would, of course, profess also to follow the so-called second pillar of monetary analysis. And I think you could these days even count the United States as an inflation targeter in a way, because the Fed is quite transparent and open about its desired rate of inflation for the future. The Bank of Thailand, as the governor said, was one of a number of emerging countries that adopted IT, as we could call it, around the turn of the century. 12 years on, Thailand can boast an impressive record of price stability under that framework. A high level of transparency has ensured that financial markets in Thailand and around the world understand the framework and view it as credible. Moreover, price stability has not come at the cost of economic growth. Output growth has been quite good in Thailand under inflation targeting. While inflation targeting is not for everybody, the Thai experience illustrates that when done well, it does enhance economic outcomes. And so I would agree with and endorse the favourable verdict offered on the Thai experience by the study by my former colleague Steve Grenville and Takatishi Ito, published a couple of years ago. So inflation targeting, including in Thailand, has been a success in terms of the simple objective set for it, that is to control inflation and not to unduly constrain growth. But to say that is not to claim that inflation targeting or controlling inflation itself is sufficient to underwrite stability in a broader sense. Indeed, if there were any thought that controlling inflation over a two-year horizon was enough, then I think we've been well and truly disabused of that by the experience globally over the past half decade. Price stability alone does not guarantee financial stability. You could argue, in fact, that the so-called Great Moderation, which was an undoubted success in terms of inflation and output, fostered or at least allowed a build-up of leverage in many key countries that ultimately were inimical to financial stability and hence macroeconomic stability. Success in lessening volatility in activity and inflation and in interest rates over time made it possible for firms and households to think that a higher degree of leverage was safe. Well, it seems safe, but higher leverage also meant that people were more exposed to distress when ultimately a large negative shock came along, which of course eventually it did. In saying that, of course, we leave a large role in causing the crisis, and in fact the major role, for poor lending standards, even fraud in some cases, fed by distorted incentives and compounded by supervisory weaknesses and the inability to see through the complexity of various financial products. Those things really played the major role in creating the crisis, but the great moderation that prompted people to accept higher leverage was also a factor. Well, really, we shouldn't be surprised, I don't think, that price stability alone does not guarantee financial stability overall. It's been understood for some time, I think, that it is very difficult to model the financial sector and that many of the standard macroeconomic models that are in use, including in central banks, had an underdeveloped modelling of the financial system. Mainstream economics, I think, was a little bit slow to see the financial sector as it really should be seen, and that is, it has its own dynamic of innovation and risk-taking and leverage. It's an amplification mechanism for shocks that hit the economy, but more than that, it's a possible source of shocks in its own right. It doesn't just passively accommodate the other parts of the economy. And that's a problem for the models, and it's a problem for the conventional monetary policy frameworks. The critique being offered now, then, in some quarters at least, is that central banks paid too little attention in the 2000s to the build-up of credit and leverage and to the role that easy monetary policy played in that. It's hard to disagree with that, though I find that finding a little bit ironical, because inflation targeting was a model to which central banks were attracted because of the failures of targeting money and credit that we had experienced in earlier times. One could note as well that the European Central Bank always had the second monetary pillar that they paid attention to, but the euro has still experienced the crisis. So the upshot of all this is that the relationship between monetary policy and financial stability is being re-evaluated. As that happens, I think it's helpful that we're moving on from the earlier and rather unhelpful framing of this discussion in terms of the question as to whether monetary policy should prick bubbles or not, or whether you can even identify bubbles. The issue isn't really whether something's a bubble. That's always a subjective judgment anyway, at least in real time. The issue is simply the potential for damaging financial instability when an economic expansion is accompanied by a cocktail of rising asset values, rising leverage, and declining lending standards. One can remain agnostic about the bubble or not bubble question, but still have concerns about the potential for a reversal in asset values to cause problems. And perhaps most fundamentally, while the connections between monetary policy and financial excesses can be complex, in the end, central banks set the short-term price of borrowing. It can't be denied, surely, that that affects risk-taking behaviour. Indeed, it is one of the intended effects of low interest rates globally at present to foster greater risk-taking behaviour. Now, that's not to say that that's wrong in the current environment, but it is one of the channels through which monetary policy works. So it follows that broader financial stability considerations do have to be given due weight in monetary policy decisions. I think that's becoming more widely accepted now. I think the challenge for central banks, though, in this, is going to be to incorporate into our frameworks all we've learned from the recent experience about financial stability or instability, but not to throw away all the things that are good about the current frameworks that we have. We learned a lot about the importance of price stability and about how to achieve that through the 1970s and 80s and 90s. We learned a lot about the importance of institutional design, the independence of the central bank in particular, in achieving price stability. We shouldn't throw that away in our desire to do more to achieve financial stability. We shouldn't make the error of ignoring older lessons in the desire to heed new lessons. Rather, we have to have both sets of objectives in mind. We will have to accept, occasionally, the need to make a judgment about short-term trade-offs. But that's the nature of policy making. And in any event, over the long run, price stability and financial stability surely can't really be in conflict. To the extent that they have not managed to coexist properly within the frameworks presently in use, I think that is in no small measure because the policy time horizon has tended to be too short, and perhaps also because people became rather too ambitious about their ability to fine-tune things in the short run. Of course, we've also got to heed the lesson that whatever framework for monetary policy we have, the practice of financial supervision, not just the rules, but the actual practice of supervision, matters a great deal. These days, of course, it's considered correct to mention that there are other ways of leaning into the wind, so to speak, of financial cycles in the form of the rather grandly labelled macroprudential tools. Well, once upon a time, when I was a much younger economist, these tools used to simply be called labelled regulation, which is what they are. They may well be useful in some instances when applied in a complementary way to monetary policy, where the interest rate that's appropriate for overall circumstances is nonetheless associated with excessive borrowing in one sector or another. In such a case, it might well be sensible to implement a sector-specific measure, a loan-to-value ratio constraint or a capital requirement or something like that. And that may well be sensible to do. We do need, however, I think, to approach such measures with our eyes open. Macroprudential tools will have their place, but if the problem is fundamentally one of interest rates being too low for a protracted period, history suggests that the efforts of regulators to constrain balance sheet growth through regulatory tools ultimately won't work. Because if the incentive to borrow is powerful enough, people will find a way to do it, even if that means that the associated activity migrates beyond the regulatory perimeter. So even in the newfound or perhaps relearned enthusiasm for regulatory tools, we need to be realistic. Let me turn now to the limits of central banking more generally, because the idea that policy measures of any kind have a limitation is a theme which with much broader application. The central banks of the major countries certainly were quite innovative in their response to the unfolding crisis over the past 5 years. Numerous programs to provide funding to private institutions against a vastly wider classes of collateral were certainly a key feature of the central bank response so far. In essence, when the private financial sector was suddenly under pressure to shrink its balance sheet because it couldn't fund that balance sheet, the central banks found themselves obliged to facilitate or slow that balance sheet adjustment by changing the size of their own balance sheets. That's the appropriate response, and there's a long tradition in central banking going back to the days of Badgett in London that dictates that response. Conceptually, at least at first, these balance sheet operations could be seen as distinct from the overall monetary policy stances of the central banks. But as the crisis has gone on, and we're 5 years now since the initial outbreak of funding problems for European banks in August of 2007 that really ushered this in, so as we've gone on, these distinctions between balance sheet operations and monetary policy have become rather blurred. And conventional policy, that is interest rates, have been pushed to its limits. I suppose it was fortuitous that the so-called zero lower bound on nominal interest rates, or what we learned about in university as the liquidity trap, had gone from being something in the textbook to being a real-world problem in Japan during the 1990s. Japan subsequently pioneered the use of so-called quantitative easing in the modern era, and that provided some basis of experience for other central banks when the crisis unfolded in such a way that we had a very deep recession and there was not enough room to lower interest rates in response after 2008. So in addition to programs which provided funding to intermediaries in order to prevent a collapse of the financial system, there have been programs of so-called unconventional monetary policy in several major countries over recent years. They've been varyingly thought of as operating by one or more of the following channels. Firstly, reducing longer-term interest rates on sovereign or quasi-sovereign debt once the overnight rate had reached zero. Reducing credit spreads to applying to private sector securities. This has been referred to as so-called credit easing. Or it can be thought of as adding to the stock of monetary assets held by the private sector, which is appealing to quantity theory of money notions of the transmission mechanism. And in the euro area in particular, there have been commitments to lower the spreads applying to certain sovereign borrowers within the currency union and this is often described as reducing so-called redenomination risk. As a result of those policy innovations, the balance sheets of central banks in the major countries have expanded very significantly. In the printed version of the remarks, there's a chart there that shows central bank assets as a share of GDP going back to 1910, and it shows that in several cases, the size of the central bank's balance sheet compared to the economy has reached or even exceeded the peaks of the Second World War. Further expansion may yet occur in some countries. Now, it's no criticism of those actions, taken as they were under extreme circumstances, to observe that they raise some very important and difficult questions for central banks. There's discomfort in some quarters that central banks are exercising an unprecedented degree of discretion, that they're introducing new policies which yield uncertain benefits and may have possible costs. One obvious consideration is that central banks, in simply managing these larger balance sheets, need to assess and manage risk across a much broader spectrum of assets than used to be the case. Gone are the days when the typical central bank held a modest portfolio of the debt issued by their own government, and that was seen as being completely risk-free. No longer the case. Central banks, in many cases, holding much broader assets now and where the credit quality is more uncertain. To date, in the major countries at least, that's worked pretty well because the yields on the assets they're holding have come down, they've earned very large profits on these holdings, and some substantial profits have been remitted to governments. But at some point, those very, very low yields will have to rise. Now, of course, for the central bank to hold considerable balance sheet risk and have a large balance sheet is not really news in Asia. And once again, here the Bank of Thailand recently held a very good conference on this very question, jointly with the BIS. The difference in Asia, of course, is that many of the risks arise from holdings of foreign currency assets which have been accumulated as a result of exchange rate management. There's obviously valuation risk on those holdings. And there's also often a negative carry on the assets because the domestic assets which effectively fund the foreign assets often carry a higher yield than the foreign obligations, especially these days, and so the central banks can experience negative carry. In effect, what that means is that the citizens of Asia, through their reserve holdings, are continuing to provide very large loans to major country governments at yields below which, yields below the yields that could be earned by deploying that capital at home. Well, for the major countries, a further dimension to what's happening, of course, is the blurring between monetary and fiscal policy, which is inevitable at this stage of the particular circumstances they face. It's true that central banks are not typically purchasing government debt directly at issue, but the size of secondary market purchases they're making and the share of the debt stock that in some cases they hold are sufficiently large that one, I think, can only conclude that central bank purchases are materially alleviating the market constraint on government borrowing. At the very least, that is lowering debt service costs, and it may also condition how quickly fiscal deficits ultimately have to be wound in. Now, there's nothing necessarily wrong with doing that, and indeed, one could argue that policies might be jointly even more effective in raising both short-term and long-term growth in major countries if central bank funding could be made to lead directly to actual public final spending, for example, directed at infrastructure, as opposed to relying on indirect effects through private spending. So it's not so much that what's being done now is wrong. The problem will be, I think, the exit from these policies when the time comes to do that. And the problem will be to reimpose the distinction between fiscal and monetary policies with the appropriate disciplines. This isn't a technical problem. The central banks will be able to design at a technical level the modalities for reversing quantitative easing when the time comes. I think the real issue is more likely to be that ending a period, a very lengthy period, of guaranteed cheap funding for governments may prove to be politically difficult. There's certainly history to suggest that, if we look back. And it's no surprise, therefore, that some people worry that we are heading a little bit, at least, back towards the world of the 1920s to the 1960s, where central banks were captured somewhat by the government of the day for public debt interest sort of reasons. Most fundamentally, I think the question is whether people fully understand the limits to what the central bank can achieve. It is, to repeat, not to be critical of the actions that have been taken so far by central banks, to wonder whether private market participants and, more importantly, governments recognise what central banks cannot do. Central banks can provide liquidity to shore up financial stability, and they can buy time for borrowers to adjust. But they cannot, in the end, put government finances on a sustainable course. They cannot create the real resources that need to be found from somewhere to strengthen bank capital positions. They cannot costlessly correct earlier misallocation of real capital investment. They can't shield people from the implications of having misassessed their own lifetime budget constraints and therefore having consumed too much. They can't combat the effects of population aging. They can't drive the innovation that ultimately raises productivity and creates new markets. Central banks can't do those things. Nor can they, or nor should they, put themselves in the position of deciding what real resource transfers should take place between countries in a currency union like Europe. So one fears, in short, that while central banks have been centre stage in the response to the crisis, and it's right that they should have been, it's right that they should have bought time for other adjustments by their bold initiatives over recent years, one fears that the limits of what they can do may become more apparent in the years ahead. A key task, I think, for central banks and a key challenge will be for us to communicate those limits, but at the same time to sustain confidence that there are solutions to the problems and to point out where those solutions might come from. Finally then, let me say some things about the challenges we face via spillovers of policies from one country to another. In one sense, this is not a new issue. It's been a cause of anxiety and disagreement at least since the latter days of the Bretton Woods era. There was a famous remark attributed to the then Secretary of the US Treasury in response to European concerns about the weakness of the US dollar in the 1970s, and he said, "It's our currency, but your problem." That was a remark about spillovers at the time. There have been other episodes of spillovers since, and one could quote them. And in a much earlier period, of course, there were the beggar thy neighbour problems of the 1930s, something which, of course, carries cogent lessons for our circumstances today. In recent years, as interest rates across a number of major jurisdictions have fallen towards zero, and as central bank balance sheet measures have increased, these developments have been seen as contributing to cross-border flows of capital in search of higher returns. Now, the extent of such spillovers is still disputed by some of the major countries, and to the extent that they are material, some have argued, and quite reasonably, I think, that a world where these extraordinary measures have been taken, even though they have spillovers, is preferable to a world in which the crisis had not been contained. And I think that's probably right. The degree of disquiet, though, in the global policymaking community does seem to have increased recently. And I think there is a well-understandable reason for that. In past episodes, expansionary policies in major countries did have spillovers through capital flows, but they also did demonstrably work to create stronger demand in the major countries themselves. Now, the policymakers in the major countries would claim, I think, that the unconventional policies they're pursuing are having that expansionary effect, in their own economies compared with the unobservable alternative of what would have happened in the absence of those policies. But the slowness of recovery in the US and in Europe and in Japan does, I suspect, leave other people wondering whether major countries are relying a bit more on exporting their weaknesses than used to be the case in previous upswings. I think it's natural for people to wonder that. Now, one response to that can be efforts in emerging countries to make their financial systems more resilient to capital inflows and outflows. Developing local currency bond markets and these sorts of things are, and currency hedging markets are, steps that we can all take to strengthen our resilience. And that sort of thing is being done, and it's underway in various forums like the G20 or EMEA. But that takes time. Meanwhile, the spillovers are here now, and so people feel a certain discomfort with this. I think that's understandable. I do think it has to be said, though, that spillovers go in more than one direction. It used to be common for policymakers in Asia and in Europe to point the finger at the US for many years about their current account deficit, and to say that the US was absorbing too big a share of the world's savings. Well, that's true, but the fact was that some of the regions that were saying that were the ones supplying the excess saving into the global system because they didn't want to use it at home. That surely had an impact on the global price of capital, and that surely found a response by the borrowers and financial institutions in America and in some other countries. So while we might want to say that in hindsight the policymakers in the US should have paid more attention to some of the financial problems that were building up as they pursued these policies, I think we might also need to concede that the US policymakers and policymakers in some other countries sought to pursue their objectives of full employment and price stability in a world conditioned by the spillovers of policies that other countries, including in Asia and in Europe and in South America and the Middle East for that matter, were pursuing. So spillovers go more than just one way. Not only that, but spillovers which might arise from policies in this region are much more important than they used to be. Asia has a much greater economic weight now than it did even a decade ago. And so policy incompatibilities which might partly arise on this side of the Pacific are going to matter much more globally than they used to. The traditional Asian strategy of export-driven growth assisted by a low exchange rate worked very well when Asia was small. But Asia isn't small anymore, and so the rest of the world won't be able to absorb the growth in Asian production the way it used to. More of that production will have to be used at home. Now, I think this is very well understood around the region, and policymakers have made good progress in reorienting their growth strategies. I suspect more of that will be needed over time. For central banks in particular, there's been talk about monetary policy spillovers being internalised into individual central banks' frameworks. Now, exactly how you might do that is not entirely clear, and that discussion is still in its infancy. One can note that the IMF does useful work on spillovers, and the IMF at least in principle offers a forum where incompatibilities in policies can at least be recognised and talked about. One far-reaching proposal I've seen is for there to be an international monetary policy committee that tries to internalise these spillovers and set a set of global policy, monetary policy settings. That seems to me at least a little, quite a long way off yet, but it's an interesting idea. For spillovers to be internalised, of course, mandates for central banks would need to be changed to allow for that. At the present time, central banks are a creation of national parliaments. They have national mandates, and it would be a very big step to change that. It can happen. The ECB is the example of where national sovereignty was ceded to the centre, a region-wide mandate was given to the ECB, and that was done because it was thought that the payoff to doing that exceeded any costs. So it can happen, but it's a pretty big step. Whether or not such a step ever occurred, of course, it's clear the spillovers, though, are with us now. All countries, all of us here, share a collective interest in preserving key elements of the international financial system, even as we all do individually what it takes to fulfil our individual national mandates. So it's vital that central banks continue to talk frankly with each other about how we perceive the interconnections of global finance to be operating. We may be limited at times by the national natures of our mandates, but those limitations need not preclude cooperative action altogether, as has itself been demonstrated at various key moments over the past 5 years. In this region, the EMEAP Forum offers great potential to further our mutual understanding and ability to come to joint positions on at least some issues. And internationally, of course, the BIS is also a key forum for truth-telling between each other in a collegiate and confidential setting, and it's one in which the central banks of this region are playing an increasingly prominent role. And I think there will be much more of that in the future. So in conclusion, Governor, the Bank of Thailand and the Reserve Bank of Australia have in our respective histories faced a number of challenges, some of them quite big ones. We've learned much from those experiences and from the experiences of others. We've had our own distinct challenges in recent years. Fortunately, neither of us have been directly at the centre of the almost unprecedented challenges faced by our colleagues in the major countries, though of course we've all been affected by what has occurred in those countries in various ways. The future in Asia is full of potential, but to realise that, we have to continue our efforts to strengthen our own policy frameworks, learn the appropriate lessons from the problems of others, and continue our efforts to cooperate on issues of key mutual interest. As the Bank of Thailand moves into its eighth decade, I'm sure that you and your colleagues will rise to the challenge. Thank you again for the invitation to be here, and happy birthday.
Well, Glenn, it's great to see you again, and thank you very much for your insightful talk this morning. I think you are very correct in pointing out that there's only a certain limit that a central bank can do in addressing all the major issues or problems that a country may have. And so I think we central bankers have an important task ahead of us to try to communicate or convey that message to the market. Perhaps given the condition, the situation that central banks in advanced economies are in a delicate situation in that they can't really tell the public that they have the limitation in the solving the problem. Maybe they could to some extent. I think it perhaps could help if the central banker community can speak up. Central banks in the countries that are not at the epicenter of the crisis. If we can all speak up a bit more to create awareness that what we need to do, especially the affected economies need to do, is to try to address the structural problem, not just relying exclusively on the monetary policy. That may create some more awareness in the advanced economies, including in our own economies as well, that it's very important that we put in more effort in the real economy and the structural long-term issues of the economy. That is my sort of the additional thought. I have a question, though it's not really related to what you have just said. But we have recently heard a lot more about the role of the currency, say yuan, renminbi, or the Australian dollars, the role as a global currency. What is your thought on this one? Is the Australian dollar ready to become one of the global currencies, and apart from diversifying the risk, would that contribute to, or in what way can it contribute to the economies in this part of the world? Thank you.
Well, I think on the Australian dollar, it's in fact long been a currency which has been part of the reserve portfolios of some central banks, particularly in this region. So that per se is not new. Probably the size of the flows in recent times are larger than they were, though we don't know for sure because we don't have the data. We have, I think it's a matter of public record, also seen some flows from some European central banks, which probably is new. I think the dynamic that's at work there is that the triple A or highly rated universe of assets is smaller because some countries have been downgraded or their credit worthiness is just a little bit more doubtful than it used to be. And so conservative investors who want the highest quality have a somewhat less choice than they did. And our currency in Australia has probably attracted some additional flows as a result of that. That's a kind of an asset diversification thing, and it's for the recipient country. It's kind of a mixed blessing because the exchange rate is probably held higher than otherwise. At the same time, it lowers the cost of capital to us as a country. So it's got two elements. On the RMB. Well, it's really a matter for the Chinese authorities at what pace they want to move in the direction of it being a major global currency. I don't think there's any doubt it will be. And the real question is, what's the particular route that they take to accommodate that? China's economy is already very large. There's already quite rapid growth in the use of the RMB for settlement of trade transactions. That's growing quite quickly. And the Chinese authorities have done some things to facilitate that. My guess is that there'll be much more of that over the years ahead. Ultimately, to be a full global currency, of course, you need to be able to hold it or not hold it as you see fit without restriction, and they're not at that point yet, but presumably over time. They will map out a path to get to that position. So that's coming, but as to the timing of it, I really am not in a position to know. Is there a further question? Sir, over here.
Going forward, under the present circumstances, the crisis seem to be springing all over the world. How do you see the world moving on? And what sort of friction going to arise from such a pattern that forward for the next 5 years and so on?
Well, I think what we're seeing now is global growth has slowed this year. It's actually not terribly bad, the pace of global growth that we have, but it is uneven. The IMF's prediction, I think, for this year and next is in the sort of a bit over 3% for global GDP. If that turns out to be right, that's actually not disastrous, but it is below average. Asia's been affected by the slowdown in the major countries, but also in China. Our sense is that the Chinese slowdown has moderated now, and China's continuing to expand, but just at a slower pace than it used to. And I think it was inevitable that they had to slow down, and I don't think we're going back to the 10 or 11% growth rates for China that we saw for some years. I'm actually relatively optimistic about the United States, presuming that they get past the fiscal cliff matter in the next month, because I think the housing sector has turned and the energy dynamic in the US is now going to favour growth, and that's very important. So China's okay, the US I think will be okay, Europe is going to be, it's going to be Europe. It's going to have, you know, a very long, difficult road to structure the common institutions they need to deal with the issues. We know that will take time, and I think they understand that, but it'll be some time before Europe, I think, is fully back on its feet. But China's okay, the US I think will be okay, and there's a tremendous growth dynamic in this region that Thailand and other countries and my own can tap into if we have the confidence to do so. So the future is not entirely gloomy. In doing that, though, we need to, you know, hold to the things that are good about the international system, pretty much free trade, capital's able to move with some restrictions, but not too restricted, sound policy frameworks domestically, all these things we have to hold on to if we're to turn that potential into a good future. But I'm relatively optimistic.
So as the session comes to an end, we only have time for one final question from Governor Prasad. Thank you.
Glenn, I hope you don't mind I join with my guest in the discussion with you. In your second challenge, in your speech, you talk a bit on this central bank's balance sheet problem. And for a number of Asian central banks, we are facing these problems of negative carries and the problem of currency valuation. The problem is financial in nature on one hand. But on the other hand, we also have the mandate to implement credible monetary policy, let's say economic policy. How much we should relate one with another, take into consideration on one side the financial problem of our balance sheet, and on the other side, the credible monetary policy.
It's not easy, is it? But I think the framework that we have, and I recognize that in some countries in Asia, the framework is different, but Our framework is we let the exchange rate move. Sometimes it's uncomfortable. It's more often than being uncomfortable on the downside, but at the moment it's uncomfortable on the upside. I think that has to impinge to some extent on the monetary policy setting. I still think that a medium-term inflation target with due modesty about what we can achieve in terms of fine-tuning, I still think that's probably the best framework on offer for us, and we will stick to that. I think the broader issues on the foreign reserve holdings for Asia, the negative carry is an issue, although for the central bank, of course, profit and loss is not our principal consideration. But I think the bigger issues are whether the hundreds of millions of hard-working Asian citizens ultimately want to lend trillions of dollars to the US and Europe for almost nothing. I think that might be a question we might all ask ourselves, whether that's a rational place to be in the long run. And in the long run, I would say as Asia's productivity per head continues to increase and converge to the leading parts of the world, the real exchange rate in Asia will rise to reflect that. That will be a dynamic that you will Thailand, but all the other countries of Asia will also face. And it will be a matter of judgment how you configure that between letting domestic costs rise or letting the nominal exchange rate rise, or some of each. That would be a judgment call. But I think that the framework that you've got and that we have is a very good metric within which to try to strike these inevitably difficult judgments. It's probably as good as I can do on that one. Thank you.